Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Moto.
Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, they eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but massively notice the weakness in all them. Gotta use it only if necessary. Homie, vestige is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind of beauty of life. Was when my mom said, if you could be Christ, I wasn't old enough to hold my D&P right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training and difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging. Splitting duchess up, strap up, the army's a school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool, got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals I build. With dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick's Hill. For fish gills, the cops love. The time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the pea. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holsters. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Of the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. A black gorilla, crib and blood and one only. Just know my face, I be the case. But the wish at the police, they'll get the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute, the new Huey Newton.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force of what we fight for. My heart goes to you, beautiful wife in war.
Enlist in more and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect and be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just for convenience.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this Western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule the strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, love and war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad brothers!
Free the Soledad brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson.
Sorry about your brother.
He will live to regret it. I'll see to that. Get him where it hurts.
Starring Gary Dordan from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Oh, free the land. Revolutionary greetings. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio. I'm your host, Bumani Shakir, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal, to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal, to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal, to transform the criminal mentality to new African mentality. Our fourth goal, to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African community. Our fifth goal, to prepare new African prisoners for release, reducing new African recidivism. Our overall goal, to transform the whole prison industrial slave complex to the prison system, to the big interest of learning through educational means. And also one of our goals as well is, once the brothers and sisters get out from behind enemy lines, to come into community, build institutions and programs that sustain the people's needs. But before I bring on a guest tonight, I'd like to say that I'd like to thank everybody for who've been listening to our broadcast since 2014, the ones who've been supporting GDAU since the inception over 20 years ago. I thank all the individuals that currently educate themselves in their respective communities and their families and currently doing something productive and build and seeking some kind of independence. I also let everybody know that we near in Black August, Ways to Go, see. Which is a time of revolution, Revolution Month that should be commemorated all year round. And I encourage people to reach out to their loved ones, their family, relatives, and associates behind enemy lines, write them, send them care packages, and just associate with, especially their political prisoner, and just all your loved ones in general. And tonight, I'd like to welcome to the show Elder Kumasi. How you doing, Elder?
Energy kind of low, but I'm willing to go through with this interview, and my energy will probably pick up as we go along. So I'm happy to talk to you. Either way it goes, I'm glad to talk to you.
Okay. I'll let you thank you for coming to the broadcast. I didn't understand. Thank you for the work you did, the past, present, and the future. And I salute you, Jeff, for your overall keeping the people abreast with history and keep people aware of what's going on, especially setting the record straight from regard to certain things that you know and experience firsthand. Before we go to the interview, can you tell us exactly what your name means?
Well, my name Kumasi is really the name of a city in Ghana that used to be the capital before Accra. It's the ancient capital of the Ashanti people. And the Ashanti people were very warrior-like people that defended the national independence of Ghana. Just recently, when I went over there, we talked to two different sets of people that were giving us a history rundown of the country. The first set we didn't agree with at all because they sanitized the colonial conquest, and the slave trade. They have this a very sanitized, prescripted spiel that they give to students, foreigners, anybody that comes through there to visit the dungeons that our people were kept in and that were led to the door of no return. So we pretty much shut that down and told them, man, we don't want to hear that shit. Just show us, take us through here, show us what they did to our people. And we're not interested in listening to the glorification of the slave masters, the conquerors and the slave owners, and looking at their monuments. If anything, we want to see their grave sites, and we want to know who put them in the grave, which people among us actually put them in the grave. But when we got to the other site, at I can't even think of the name of it now, but it wasn't far away at all. They gave us a beautiful rundown, and they showed us pictures, and they showed us the fact that there was a king that came from Europe, come over there to try to take the gold from Ghana, and they cut his damn head off. And so there was a sister that had some rank with them at Ashanti community that had another king fired because he wouldn't chop no heads off, because he wouldn't attack and fight and kill those who would come into the country to disrupt the life there and to take all of their wealth and freedom from them. So anyway, Kumasi was the original capital of Ghana. The way they chose the name, there was three major regions and three different ethnic groups. You had the Ashanti, you had the Fulani, and there's another group I can't remember the name of. And they occupied three different sectors. And so rather than show any favoritism, this is how we're going to choose the capital. We're going to take the seeds of a Kumanini tree, and we're going to plant those seeds in all three areas. And wherever the seeds blossom first, and that's going to be the cap. We're going to let the seeds choose which area is going to be the capital of the country. And the seeds took bloom and blossomed in Kumasi, in the Ashanti land. So that was the original capital. Ghana was called Gold Coast. The Europeans would come over and they would notice that you had gold dust all on the sidewalks and on the ground, on the pavement, that the sisters over there were walking around with gold nugget earrings and lots of gold around their neck, the way you see rappers doing today. That's what they noticed when they got to Ghana. You had gold reflections off the lakes and rivers. And so one of the things they had heard about the golden stool that the king, Osei Tutu was the king at the time, and he had a golden stool made out of solid gold, and the Europeans wanted that golden stool, and so they kept searching for it. They came in with weapons, kind of overpowered the people to a certain extent, but the closer they got to that golden stool, the more nervous and agitated the people got, and the more willing they were to fight just for that golden stool. And so they have a thing called the legend of the golden stool and the king Osei Tutu. So because they had schools of higher learning there in Ghana, just like Songhe and Timbuktu, because of the richness of the wealth of the land, because of the rich culture that they had and the combatant spirit of the men, then names are supposed to be attributes. You ask me, what does that name mean? In other words, what is this attribute? Well, I just gave you all of the attributes of that country. It was high in cultural development, a high sense of education, richness, okay, and spirit and culture and combativeness. And all of those things I knew were already incorporated into my own personality, and so I took the name Kumasi and lived up to it. And I was proud to visit Kumasi late in my life, but before I died.
Okay, I appreciate that. That's a very rich history, very profound. For the people who are listening, people who are going to be listening in the future, right? Tell the people about you, so they can know exactly who's talking, what perspective you're coming from, and where are you coming from. Tell the people about you, like where you grew up at, what you've been involved with, what developed you, things of that nature, you know.
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, but I was born in New York. And, you know, I come out of the streets of L.A. And so by the time I was 10 years old, I joined a club called Slauson. But Slauson was the umbrella of all the different clubs in my neighborhood. Slauson is like the baobab tree. It is a tree with many branches. And the branch that I joined at 10 was called Flips. And I think one of the reasons why we called ourselves the Flips, because we were tumblers. We all practiced gymnastics and tumbling at a very early age, and we were always near the sand pile with the rings, and we were doing our roundoffs and handsprings, and, you know, we also excelled in gymnastics even at school. So some brother that was older than us came to a table one day and said, "Man, you little guys are always together every day, just like brothers. Why don't you call yourselves the brothers?" So at first we called ourselves brothers, then we became blood brothers. And a few days later I came in the park and they said we're flips, or royal flips. Well, back in those days, all gangs were, first of all, social clubs. Started off as social clubs. Some would have a social club and a car club mixed in. And they gave dances, social events, and they wore jackets with emblems on them. Well, we didn't have jackets. We didn't have an emblem, but we had a flamboyant dress style. You know, we actually set certain dress codes and dress standards, high standards of dress. And we had teachers at the high school level complaining to the principal that we would come into school dressed better than them. And they were grown and had professional businesses. And they really wanted us to dress down, but we never did. So that's the climate I grew up in. But I got my politics from the fact that, you know, what you don't see today that we saw then was people that looked just like us, not much older than us, in the streets, fighting, and in the fields, fighting for their freedom. And so we saw I grew up watching every country on the continent of Africa win its freedom and independence. Now, it won its political freedom, but it didn't win the economic freedom or solvency that it should have, because the World Bank controls everybody's money. And the Africans have the prettiest money in the world, but most of it doesn't have a lot of value to it. Today, that is starting to change because they're starting to nationalize their national products. They're starting to allow their money by force and by economic relationships with people outside of the nation, but outside of the continent of Africa, is helping to build their economy so that their money, for instance, the Ghanaian city, the name of their money is called Citi. That city is climbing all up the back of the American dollar. And eventually, it will either equal or be worth more than the American dollar. And one of the reasons is because all money on the planet is backed by what? Gold. And what do you call Ghana? Gold Coast. You still have English bullion companies coming into Ghana and leaving there every day with armored trucks full of gold bullion. But you do have people there who still own land which has gold on it. And not only does the land that they live on have gold on it, but it also has gold mines, and they got gold miners, and they got gold merchants. So all of the gold in Ghana does not belong to Europeans, but a significant amount of it does. And they are working as hard as they can to change the attitudes of the people within that country, the politicians within that country, the merchants within that country, and make them understand that they should own all their land, they should own all the wealth that is within their land, and they ought to stop paying a debt to people who then ripped them off and then turn around and said, you're in debt. We stole everything that you got, and you got to pay us for the possessions that we have that originally belonged to you that we're selling back to you whenever we can with a high tax and a high interest rate. So I've watched all of these countries. Ghana was the first country on the continent of Africa to gain its freedom in 1957. And the man responsible for that was the first president of a free and independent African nation, and his name was Osagyefu Kwame Nkrumah, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. He was moving to modernize the country so fast that he was accused of wasting wealth, you know, to trying to turn the country into a flamboyantly modern country. And they used tribal people who was opposed to him already. And when he went outside of Africa, they deposed him. The CIA and the English got together and made sure he could not return home to the country he was the president of. And that's when Ahmed Sekou Touré, who was the president of the Republic of Guinea, invited him to come to the Republic of Guinea and live there and be president for life. And that president, Dr. Ahmed Sekou Touré, was never overthrown, never ousted, and his country was never brought down in any kind of way. When they gained their independence from the French took everything out of that country, hoping that they couldn't survive, that they couldn't manage their own political affairs, that they couldn't manage their own national economy and their political apparatus or the civic structure of their nation in a way that the people would still be compatible with one another instead of warring against each other every day. They even took light bulbs with them. They took everything. They tried to dismantle that country. That man worked tirelessly day and night, kept that country on its feet until his death. And so that's my background, watching them, watching Ghana, watching the Republic of Guinea, watching Patrice Lumumba liberate the Congo and then become assassinated, watching Ahmed Ben Bella in Algeria and the guy that replaced him, watching every country, watching the Mau Maus. Oh, the Mau Maus name was so fiendish in the 1950s, around 54, 55, and 56. Their name made Europeans tremble in their boots, man. Their name was more treacherous, more terrifying than Al-Qaeda or anybody else that has come up since. Oh, they were definitely afraid of the Mau Mau. And so we even had groups, we had gangs in this country. Even one of the cliques out of Slauson for a time called itself the Mau Maus. You know, but they understood how much fear they had registered to oppressive people. So, you know, anyone that belonged to that oppressive element. But we watched every country. And so we believe that a revolution, a successful revolution, was possible because we saw people in our generation waging revolutions and gaining their freedom and independence every day. We saw the Cuban Revolution. We saw it with our own eyes. We watched it on television. And we saw, here's a small nation. It became a fact to us that a small nation can defeat a large nation, that a weak nation can defeat a strong. And that gave us the confidence to believe in ourselves and our ability to stand up, quit trembling, and come onto ourselves as a people and to try to measure us alongside of the smartest, the strongest, the most capable and accomplished people on earth, and stop looking at ourselves as an underdog, stop looking at ourselves as a weakling, stop looking at ourselves as victims. But we knew that in reality, we were victors. We were we had won victories over all the things that had happened to us that was meant to destroy us, to wipe us off this planet, and we were still here, and we still had some heart, we still had some strength. All we needed was to be on the right side of an argument that faced us. And so what really was important at that time was that we unify ourselves, come together in a sense of saying all for one and one for all, instead of bickering and fighting with each other and killing each other over little simple things that really didn't. And so that's the element that I came out of and that I grew up with as a combatant, not only in the street, but ready to fight anybody, anywhere, anytime when the issue was about us.
True indeed, true indeed. You know, there's two things I want to ask you about, you know, in regard to the Slauson. You know, many times we aren't heard in history in regard to, like, the Slauson participation in the 6-5 White Rebellion, and also the Slauson's contributing to the demise of the white supremacist group, the Spook Hunters, right? What is your take on those two issues?
Well, we considered ourselves Panthers before the Panthers. Simple as that. Like I said, we had that combative spirit. In 1961, some white dude wouldn't let a black girl get on a horse at the carousel down at Griffith Park. And that started, we were the ones that kicked it off. Matter of fact, no, Robert Safo from South Park actually started that fight, but we were the ones who turned the police car upside down. Bubble up in them. They flipped the police car over and whooped everybody out there in that park that day. That was 1961. In 1965, we were the ones who defended, they called it the Watts riot, but Watts wasn't even in it for 2.5 days. We were the ones out there fighting, turning over police cars, had them on the run, ducking, hiding, trying to get away from us. They had to bring the National Guard in, and we didn't really care about them. So we considered ourselves the baddest running street fighters in America, and we took them on. And we bragged about the fact that we had won that fight. They publicized it in the press saying that we didn't do nothing but tear up our own community and burn up. That's a damn lie. And they lied about the death count, you know. So, you know, there was a significant number of people who were killed, and they were innocent. They weren't even doing it. Some people got killed because they was living on top of a shoe store or something, and people started raiding the shoe store, and they started bringing their furniture and stuff out because they knew that once they finished looting the shoe store, they were going to set it on fire. So they started pulling their stuff out of the house onto the street, and the police would shoot them, or the National Guard would shoot them, saying that they were looters. You had people who worked outside the city listening to their radio on the way home, but they was listening to music. And as they came into their neighborhood, they would see soldiers in the street waving at them, trying to make them stop. They didn't understand what was going on, and they would keep going, and so they would shoot them because they kept driving and wouldn't stop. Those are the kind of people that was getting killed. The combatants didn't get killed. We fought 6 days, day and night. We was in the street fighting them, and none of us got killed. We visited the graves of people who did get killed during that event. And we witnessed the fact that they were searching for firemen and policemen that disappeared during that they never found them. And they didn't count them among the people that was killed, but they couldn't find them. They couldn't account for them. So, you know, and that's why by the time I got busted and went to prison in 1966, I had no respect for a white authority. I had no respect for prison authority. I just, you know, I've been among people who have been fighting and defeating those kind of people from the time I was, you know, in elementary school. And now I'm 18, 19 years old, and I just don't believe those people are better than us in any way, shape, or form. So I was prepared not only to defy them, but to fight them and to look for anybody else within the prison population that had that same kind of character, personality, and idea about themselves. And I found them, and we got together, and we just, you know, basically didn't take no shit.
Okay. My next question is, you mentioned the black clubs earlier and the social clubs. Were these criminal organizations or a criminal minded or were they more in tune to like doing for community or community oriented? Well, what type of development or what type of category would you place these? People like the Schlossens and the Bandage Man, the Westside Farmers, the Rebel Rock. What kind of position were you placed them at from your own experience? Just for historical and clerical purposes.
They were all basic social clubs at first. And their identity started in the neighborhood in which they grew up, the park in which they all played together at, and the schools that they went to. That was what united them. That's what gave them the greatest common bond among themselves. So, no, these were just guys growing up that banded together. And, if you know, they were, like I say, social clubs. But if you tried to break up their party or tried to invade their neighborhood, you know, you would find out that they would fight real well. And the fighting and the means of fighting began to escalate year after year. You had amongst them, you might have 1,000 members of a gang, and you might have 7 or 8 of them that pull robberies. You know, you might have 3 or 4 of them that pull burglaries. Roach, who was one of the most prominent little flossers, didn't allow anybody to snatch an old lady's purse coming home from work off the streetcar at night, because he said that's got to be somebody's mom in the neighborhood. He didn't allow nobody to rape no young girls in the neighborhood because he said that's got to be one of our girlfriends or one of our sisters. So hands off. You can't do that kind of stuff. You know, so that kind of was pretty much the attitude. You had cats like Hatchet, man, that, you know, he carried a coat over his arm with a hatchet under it, and when the three-wheel motorcycle cop tried to give him a ticket for jaywalking, pulled a hatchet out on him, and the man's sweat popped off his face. He jumped on the motorcycle and drove off real fast. He probably never called it in. You know, he was in shock. We had people who would jump on teachers, jump on coaches, who would, you know, not in a wild, random, senseless way, but just to let them know, I'm a man. I'm not your boy. I'm a man. I'm a, you know, and I'm going to act like a man, and you're going to treat me like a man, and I'm not going to let you stand over me. I'm not going to let you lord over me. I'm not going to let you abuse me or disrespect me in any kind of way. I'm going to hold my mug. I'm going to hold my own. And so that was the posture, man. We watched them beat up on other school kids. Well, school I went to, all boys school called Reese, that you had to go to after you got kicked out of regular public school. I used to watch the staff there beat up guys and then mop the blood off the floor with them. Use them like the mop and mop the blood up and chase them home and beat them up and drag them back and whoop them again. And if they fought well enough to defeat the grown folks that was jumping on them, they called the police, and then the police would come and beat them up and take them to jail. You know, they even had a closet, a vestibule that they would put you in. You couldn't even see. It was just big enough for two people to sit and face each other with their knees up in the dark, and they couldn't even see each other. And they would keep them in there all day long. They had paddles and razor straps, and if you did something the teacher didn't like, then they want to give you a certain number of swats with the razor strap. And if you thought you was too grown to take them swats, then he would jump on you. If the teachers down the hallway heard the fight between you and that teacher, they would run out to class and they would rat pack you, run you down the stairs to the principal's office, and they would jump on you again. You know, I mean, that's how I grew up, with all that kind of stuff. So I grew up with an attitude that was opposed to that kind of stuff, and we're always looking for somebody who would help stop it, who would jump in the fight, wouldn't let a gang of teachers beat up on a student that was from their gang or their neighborhood or in their class, you know, and just sit back and watch that. Who is going to interfere? If we're walking down the street and you see a black woman getting beat by the police with billy club, you're just going to drive by and say, well, ain't none of my business. We were the type that would get involved. We wouldn't just keep going. We were the type that would jump out the car, you know, and defeat the ones and attack somebody who was attacking you, even if we didn't know you. We didn't take that. And so that was one of the reasons why the thing jumped off in 1965, because when they stopped Marquette Fry and decided to take him to jail, and his mother was standing there begging him not to take him to jail, and he was drunk and was arguing with his mother and the police, and they took him, and then they took his mother to jail, and then a sister came from across the street and spit on the police, and they jumped on her, and she hung out the window and said, y'all ain't gonna do nothing? And, of course, brothers responded. So, you know, I mean, there's just different types of attitudes among our people, man. Some people are apathetic, you know, and ain't sensitive towards anybody outside of themselves. And then you got people that, you know, are very defensive towards any aggression towards them, and will also defend anybody else that they consider the underdog or somebody who doesn't deserve the aggression that some authority figure is using against them, and they will intervene. And so when you start grouping those kind of people up, and then they realize that these are societal rules and these are societal mandates, that you have some masters over the people who are just supposed to be peons and peasants and, you know, the riffraff and the underling, you know, the downtrodden, the wretched of the earth. So, you know, you've got people within that class eventually somewhere at some time going to stand up to all of it. And if they win their conflict with those type of forces, they give encouragement to other people someplace else in the country and someplace else in the world. They see themselves in the same position and the same likeliness, and they say, you know what, they defeated them, so can we. And that's how we watched wars of national independence and revolutions waged throughout the world. It was because of the success of somebody someplace else that taught us, success is possible. You can buck City Hall and win. You can do all the things that everybody else is shivering and shaking in their boots, talking about, oh, you can't do that. You know, we found out, yeah, you could do it. You could do it. You could win, and you can get away with it, you know. And I'm one of those who was a living testimony to that, you know. Everybody says there's no way in the world I should have lived this long. When I come out of prison, people would see me on the street. They would grab me and they would hug me, pick me off the ground and cry. Said, man, we thought we were never going to. We just knew them white folks were going to kill you in there. But I survived that. And so I survived long enough to spit into the wind and say, I beat them. You know, I'm not a hump in the ground. You can't count me amongst the broken men. I got away clean, you know, and I left behind those who didn't get away clean, those who did die in those conflicts, those who were left, like Rochelle McGee, behind for more than 50 years with no way out, you know. And so all of that is still inside of me. How do you live a life like that? How do you witness that? How do you live with people and watch them die, watch them brutalize every day, watch them, you know, chained to the Florida dungeon, and you know them, and you eat with them, and you speak with them all the time, you know, and you have to leave them behind. They let you out, but they keep them in. So do you really feel free? Of course not. You don't feel free. You know, you'll eventually adapt the attitude that none of us is free until all of us is free. How can you say, I'm blessed, I'm feeling good, and you know somebody in your family, somebody on your block, somebody in your lifetime is being tortured, you know, is being driven over every day, right in front of you. And what do? Take a blind eye to it, turn your head, act like it ain't happening, you push it out of your mind and forget about it? You know, I ain't that kind of person. And that's not the kind of people that I ever ran with.
Okay. I appreciate that. You know, my next question is, how did a lot of these black clubs start making a transition in the 60s into being Panthers, Us, Ram, and other movements that were considered a black liberation movement in 1960? How did they make that transition? Or, you know what I'm saying, what do you think caused it? I know you were saying earlier about they all were resistant. They had a mentality that they wanted. They were courageous. How did the transition come about in particular? And where particular groups became what?
Who else do you think is going to put on a black leather jacket, a beret, and hold a shotgun in his hand and defy the police with the posture, if you shoot at me, I'm shooting back? Unless he came out the street, and that's his background, shooting and shooting back. You know, I used to tell certain people, I don't think that somebody can make a good revolutionary unless he's been in some kind of gang fight. You know, unless he's had a gun, a knife, a bumper jack, a bat, or something in his hand and fought hard in the street, fought to the death in the street, he ain't gonna have a heart to stand up against somebody with a gun. He ain't gonna have a heart to defy the great forces of not resistance, but of repression. He's not gonna have that kind of heart. He ain't gonna have that kind of stomach unless he come out the street with that. Robert Williams was in the military. And when he come out the military and they elected him to be the head of the to be the president of the NAACP in his township in North Carolina, you got to remember, first thing he did was went and got all the guys that was in the army with him and armed them. He didn't go get somebody, man, who ain't never picked up a gun. He didn't get somebody who only carried a Bible and not a gun. You got to keep everybody in their own proper perspective. You don't ask a blind man to be your lookout. You don't ask a preacher to carry your gun. He's a man of the cloth and the book and the word. And he ain't going to carry no gun, not too many of them, except the one that was over there in Cairo, Illinois, that young 22-year-old Reverend Cohen, who stood up against the Klan and had a poster, a picture of himself, and a poster of a Bible with a glass of water and a pistol on top. And when they decided to go on a boycott and not support none of the white businesses in Cairo, Illinois, and they lived in the pyramid projects and the sheriffs, and the businessmen would get in their cars and they would caravan past the projects and shoot at the projects, do drive-by shootings on the projects all night long. They was on the floor returning fire. Jesse Jackson and them had to come up from the south and bring food and supplies to them because they wasn't going to buy none in the town that they lived in. And they fought and they demonstrated until they won their respect. So, you know, it takes a certain combative attitude. If you don't put on a uniform and pick up a gun and go die in a battlefield somewhere else in the world for some people who hate you and ain't going to never give you no freedom, then, you know, there's something wrong with you if you won't fight at home for your freedom. And besides your family and friends and your neighbors and your community, and fight against those who's holding your freedom back. Something's got to be wrong with you. So the kind of people that came out the street, that joined RAM, they understood what was going on. They understood clearly what was happening to their people. They weren't deaf. They weren't dumb. They weren't blind, you know, and they weren't insensitive to the things happening to their people here and around the world. We didn't only identify with the freedom struggle in this country. We identified with the freedom struggles in the Caribbean, the freedom struggles in Africa, the freedom struggles in Asia. We identified with all of that. And so we understood that at the same time that you're going to fight these people and you're going to demand that they respect and quit holding your freedom back in this country, you got to fight them if you see them holding back the freedom of black folks in Africa, the freedom of black folks in Haiti, the freedom of black folks in Cuba and Puerto Rico and Venezuela or any place else in this world. Down in the Indian Ocean somewhere, in Guam, you know, the Fiji Islands, in Australia. People talk about the Tasmanian devil, but they don't realize that the island of Tasmania, which is off the coast of Australia, was colonized by the British. They come over there and they killed every black woman and child. Black man, woman, and child on that island of Tasmania in order to put together a luxurious resort. And they had a documentary I watched. There was an old sister that was in a museum, and every time that they killed some black folks, they would cut their heads off, and her job in the museum was to put their heads on a shelf like woodknots. And before the movie was over with, the documentary rather, before it was over with, her head was up there. I mean, these are the kinds of things, if you know about this and you watch this and you understand what is going on and you know what's happening there, can happen here, you're going to fight hard as you can to prevent it. You know what I'm saying? They can't come to my door with that. They ain't going to do me like that. I'm not going for it. I ain't going to stand there and watch and do my children, my wife, my sister, my mama. I'm not going for it. So, the people that would pick up guns, or the people who would stand up and protest, the women and men who would sing protest songs against it. Look at Miriam Makeba, got chased out of South Africa, had to come live over here because they were going to kill her for singing a freedom song. Same thing with Hugh Masekela. Both of them come over here in 1965 because they were going to kill them in South Africa because they sang forbidden songs, freedom songs. Look at Nina Simone. She was always singing protest songs. Even Lena Horne, started singing for James Brown. You know, he quit talking about Papa got a brand new bag. He sung a song, We're a Winner. And they banned that song in Soledad Prison because of the sentence in that song that said, and we don't mind leaving here to show the world we have no fear because we're a winner. And they banned that song because it fired us up. Ain't keep on pushing. Too far gone to turn around. Everything going to be all right in the morning song. Those were like, man, code songs to us, telling us it's time to make those moves. It's time to assault the master's cabin on the plantation, set it on fire, and chop him up. Well, I got to Soledad. All them brothers was walking around talking about all they wanted to do was take part in a baptismal bloodbath. That's all they was talking about. Eldridge and Bunchy had already put the spirit in them, saying a slave of natural death who dies cannot balance the weight of two dead flies on the scales of eternity. And in his poem, he says, I'd rather be without the shame. A bullet lies within my brain. And if I work not to reach our goal, freedom, let bleeding cancer torment my soul. And we figured anybody who didn't take that position was some kind of coward and traitor. So, you know, it wasn't a question to us about what kind of person does it take to take up the stance. What kind of person does it take to sit down and not take up that stance? That's what we want to know. What kind of chump won't stand up and be a man and protect himself, protect his family, protect his race? It's not what kind of man will do it. It's what kind of fool, sucker, and chump won't do it.
Okay. That's a lot of information there. I know you mentioned that you went to prayer in 1966, right? When exactly did you know that you that your mentality would change and that you you gained information on your beneficiary to the people that you had? Now, when you actually knew this, or what were the catalysts in there that caused you to engage into revolutionary ideology, that caused you to be, quote-unquote, a radical, or, you know, somebody who opposed the system?
When I was very young, and we used to go to the movies, before you got to see a movie, they showed you cartoons and a newsreel. The newsreel showed you the revolutions. They didn't even know that they were shunned. I mean, it was just news to them. And they didn't know that news was going to turn us on, was going to wake us up. And you're looking at the mile-mile struggle. You're looking at the Bang Dun. 1955, they had a Bang Dun conference in Bang Dun, Indonesia, where all of the non-white people in the world, representing 95% of the world's people, came together and declared they was no longer going to allow Europeans to control their lives and destiny. And then you had people like, there was a man over there, his last name was Sihanouk, all right? And there was images of him with his fez on. And what we used to call, I forgot what we used to call those shirts, those jackets, man, where you could barely see the white something under, you know, but it was closed neck without a collar, jackets and stuff. And we liked that style, for one thing. And we liked the fact that here he was standing up to Europeans. He was, you know, and he took a very strong stance. We saw people like Gamal Abdel Nasser from Egypt. We saw all kind of people, man, stand up with some heart, man, and speak out and say, our country is not going to accept this. Just not going to happen. We saw Muammar Gaddafi take over Libya when he was only about 27, 28 years old. And when he was 27, 28 years old, we were 20, 21, 22 years old. So we didn't see it was so unlikely that we could win the same kind of victories, that we could have the same kind of accomplishments. We didn't see that it was unlikely that we could actually develop the kind of statesmanship that we could bring about statehood and national leadership. We saw ourselves, and not as people of conscience, we saw ourselves as people on the rise to the extent we were going to use all our talents, all our intellect, and our political stance to someday rise to the level of political leadership, not on a community level, on a national level. We knew that we were just as equipped to be presidents, prime ministers, emperors or whatever it took. Any other sucker that we saw taking that position, you got drunk ass Joe Biden. Yeah, you look at the people that run this country, a bunch of ragtag stumblebums. You mean to tell me you can't measure yourself against them and see yourself greater than them? And that's what we did. We measured ourselves vis-a-vis everybody else. When I read about Napoleon, when I read about the Caesars of Rome, when I read about Alexander the so-called great, I measured them against guys that I grew up with. I said Alexander the Great wouldn't have been great in L.A. coming across Slauson Park. He got knocked out. He got beat up coming into the park. Napoleon wouldn't have been no conqueror, no ruler. He couldn't have got across the Fox Hills Mall without some youngster mugging him. And when I look at all the tough guys that I grew up, the combatants, the guys that had a lot of heart, that had a lot of intellect, and a lot of forcefulness about themselves, I read about all these other characters in history, and I measured them against the guys that I saw in the streets and in prison and that I grew up with. And man for man, character by character, I say if all we had to do was fight them on the battlefield with a horse, a chariot, a sword, and a shield, we would be able to whoop them all over the place. So we grew up at the wrong time where now it's man against machine, man against technology. It ain't man against man no more. You pit us man, against anybody else in the world. We're going to win. And so that's what drove me not to ever consider them as superior to me or anybody I grew up with. Because I grew up with some men and some women and far superior to the people that run this world. And when I had a chance to speak to some youngsters in Oakland, California, about 20 years ago at a youth conference, I told them, the people that run this world are some old, decrepit, out of touch with your reality bums, and you need to stop the world and throw them off and quit licking their boots. And so I had that attitude, man, at a very young age because I had a chance to see strong personalities, man, who didn't take no stuff all over the world. And then by the time you had the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa, by the time you had the student uprising in Soweto where school children revolted against the South African apartheid and they shot them down in the streets, and the next day another schoolyard full of children hit the streets to rebel again. And I'm looking at them and I say, what's wrong with us? You're around here talking about you tough, fussing and cussing. You want to fight, beat each other up. Why don't you beat up those who you're supposed to beat up? Why are you taking your frustration and your anger and your aggression out on each other? Look at them kids over there in South Africa. Look how tough they are. And those are well-mannered kids, but enough is enough. And they took to the street in defense of their country, in defense of their race, in defense of their age group. These kids fighting for kids against grown, murderous members of an apartheid regime. And we sitting over here watching Bugs Bunny, finger stuck up your nose, giggling like everything's okie-dokie. And you're getting treated just as bad as them, but you refuse to believe it. Now all of a sudden, after we done told you year in, year after we done stood up all quarters of the country, and we done lost members of the movement every year for more than 60 years. Now all of y'all talking about, oh, Black Lives Matter, and now you realize you're being abused. Now you realize that you're being oppressed. What's different between what's going on with your ass today and what happened with us 60, 70, 100, 200, 300 years ago? What's the difference? What does it take to wake your ass up and make you face reality instead of running from it, sticking your head in the ground like an ostrich and acting like ain't nothing really going on that bothers you? I'm blessed. How you do? I'm blessed. I tell the truth. I'm cursed. As long as I live in this damn country and got to go through what I'm going through and watch other people go through what they're going through, that ain't no blessing. That's a curse. So if you so blessed, go in your pockets, pull them out, and show me your blessings. Matter of fact, share some with me because I need them. So it ain't a matter of when that I turn this way. It was always like that. First as an observer, as a learner, and eventually as a participant.
Yeah, very interesting. Can you tell us more about your? Can you tell us about your experiences? Your history with the late Tony Gilson, as well as when you met Conrad George. Please elaborate on that for those who are listening. Those who are listening in the near future. And tell a little about the individuals. Who are the individuals? Sniffy to have to you, as well as to the movement.
Tony came to a joint that I was in. He came from Nellis, which was a younger youth detention center, to the one that I was in. He got kicked out of Nellis, and he came to Paso Robles. And at the time he came to Paso Robles School for Boys, I was considered the Duke. I was considered like the Muhammad Ali of the place. There were guys that could whoop me, but they didn't know their own strength, and they were afraid to fight me, and I was glad. So I was just considered throughout the whole institution as what they called the Duke. And that was white, black, brown, everybody saw me as the Duke. So I worked in the Tony came to live in the same building I was in, slept in the same dorm. He was really, really aggressive, and I took him in the gym, and I started teaching him my fighting techniques. He was already a good fighter, but he wasn't as good as me. And I always knew he was going to challenge me. And I would always tell him, I haven't taught you everything I know. I've taught you a lot of it. And so we used to, you know, we used to jump on each other. We used to hit each other. You know, matter of fact, we had a thing where anytime we could catch the other one off guard, we could fire on him, hit him inside his ear with our fist. And I woke up one morning, he was straddling the bed I was in. I'm laying on my back, and he's punching me in my face. We would take towels and wrap them up like boxing gloves and sit on the bed and face each other and just attack. We would fight inside of closets. We would get in a fireplace. Sit out in the fireplace and face each other and throw hands at each other. So he was highly aggressive, and he called me out one night, and I didn't want to fight him, but he wouldn't let me back down. And they called it the Duel of the Titans. We took our shoes and socks off, rolled our pants cuffs up, and we fought. And at first, all I was trying to do was just defend myself because he was my partner. I didn't even want to fight him. Then it got to the point after I had knocked him down and I split his lip and he kept bleeding and going to the bathroom and washing his face and coming back and ready for another round, I decided to end the fight. I was going to hit him. He was going to counter and I was going to march him. Pop, 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 pop. And then draw back and hit him with a right to take him out. And when I drew back the right hand to take him out, he hit me first. Bang! And he hit me in my left eye. My right hand was already broken when I dropped him and hit him three times before he hit the ground. And I had already broken my right hand. All I had to fight with was my left hand, but I was still going to use the right hand. It just wasn't that good. So he went to the bathroom. I sat out, was blinding me. I only had one eye to look out of, and the lights was blinding my other eye, and I had one weak hand. He still had two good hands. He still had his balance, and he still had his wind. And I said, if I come out this time, he stands a chance of knocking me out and taking my rep. So when he came out this time, I say, I'm through. We'll have to fight another day. We can call this a draw. And we never fought again, but we see each other again. That was in 63. So in 1967, 68, he comes to Soledad from Tracy in 68, 5 years later. And we're still friends, so I tell him, look, man, he learned karate from a US organization guy named Bairidi, which means ice, which means cold. And Bairidi was real good in the art. He was real good in the race riots in Tracy with the martial arts. So I told Tony, it's only fair that you teach me what you know. When we met, I taught you what I knew, and you called me out. And I know you're going to challenge me again to a fight someday. You're so aggressive, you will fight yourself. I said, so you teach me what you know. Make it even. So we started working out very aggressively. Matter of fact, we would attack each other so hard with the martial arts, assimilated combat, that people standing around would back off. They would run off. They wouldn't even want to stand there and watch us attack each other. So George Jackson finally comes to Soledad, and he's in the same housing area as Tony. And he had observed Tony teaching me karate. And he told him, he said, man, why don't you let me teach you my bastardized form of kung fu? It's a lot deadlier than what you're teaching him. You know, you guys are just using attack moves designed to hurt, to break bones, and all that kind of stuff. You know, he said, but my stuff is deadly. You know, and that's what I wanted. I thought the martial arts was not meant as a elaborate form of boxing, but it was a way of using your body as a weapon. You know, like I told the guards later on after I got real good from George's lessons, and they would shake me down, and I would stand against the wall, and I would tell them, I'm what you're looking for. And they said, what do you mean? I said, you're looking for, this is a weapon shakedown, right? And they said, yeah. I said, I'm the knife, I'm the pipe, I'm the gun, I'm what you're looking for. You're patting me down looking for a weapon, and I'm letting them know I am the weapon, you know, and I meant that. So anyway, George started teaching him, and then he would teach me what George taught him. George wouldn't talk to me at first. He didn't talk to anybody else because he had come down from San Quentin. And he had was told that if he did a year clean with no disciplinary incidents, that they would let him go home. And so he didn't want to be walking around talking to anybody else. He didn't want them to think that he was organized and trying to put anything together. His very presence already automatically drew attention. He could just walk by himself, very quiet, in a very manly way. He did not swagger. And he said he didn't swagger because he didn't think it was manly or mature. And he carried himself in a very mature manner. He didn't shout. He didn't fuss. You know, he used logic when he talked to you. You know, I was the kind who would browbeat somebody, tell them, oh, fool, blah, 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 and be threatening and browbeating, you know. And he would say, don't do that, comrade. He'd say, check this out. Instead of him giving you an argument, he would give you a mathematical equation, or he would give you a scenario and ask you, how would you work this equation out? How would you deal with this particular scenario? And you would think about it, and you would come back, I'd do this, I would do that. This is how I would handle that situation. This is my problem-solving technique. He wouldn't say you were wrong. He would just say, well, what do you think about this? And his method would be so sound, so practical. You couldn't argue with it. You say, if you was on the tier with him in the hole and you were talking loud and making noise and cackling and carrying on, and he wouldn't tell you shut up. He would say, check this out, comrade. And he would give you a mental problem to solve. knowing it's going to take you 15 to 20 minutes racking your brain trying to figure out how to solve it. And during that time period, just being quiet, and he could study, he could write a letter, do whatever he wanted to do because he got rid of the noise. So, I mean, and people said, well, what was he like? I said, he was not like they had him in none of the movies. He was not like the character in Blood in My Eye or whatever that movie is, especially the one that you played coming on to the program. That was absolutely nothing like him, okay? And he didn't train with people like that. He trained in secret. He didn't train out in the open in a regimented format, okay, in a machine. Every time we worked out, we found a bathroom, a shower room, a closet. We started working out because I was a librarian in the pen. And in the back of the library, I had a secret Swahili class. Now, I could teach dudes how to speak Swahili so that they would have a language that they could speak that nobody would understand. And as long as they didn't talk in conspiratorial tones, they could speak right out in the open and nobody would even know that they were trying to speak in secret. And so I was teaching Swahili. And I had a blackboard and I had school desks back there and all that kind of stuff. And so he would want to come back in the back of the library and use that space to practice assimilated combat. And I had to make an agreement with him, a contract with him. If you're going to come back in and disrupt my Swahili class, you have to let me in the combat class. So, and he agreed. And so that's when me and him and Tony got together. And as we worked with him and he took us and he showed us how to put calluses on our hands, he showed us how to put spurs and calluses. And one day he told Tony, he says, your hands ain't healing because you have to bust your hand, your knuckles up, and you have to make them bleed. And then you have to keep banging your knuckles until the blood turns into a scab. And then you have to bust the scab and you just keep hitting and keep pounding until all of a sudden the callus, you know, starts to grow over the scab, and then you see the calluses develop. And, you know, and there's a certain part on the bottom of your palm of your hand near the wrist, and you can make a spur. You can make that stick out. You know that picture you see of George on a visit with his mother? You seen that picture of George on a visit, and he's got his arms around his mother?
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
Next time you look at it, look at his hands. Look at his hands. My hands used to look like that. My hands used to look so much like that that I had to let all that swelling and let the calluses go away, because anybody who would look at my hand could tell what I knew. And everything we did, man, was in secret, man. We didn't wear tattoos. We didn't fly flags. We didn't wear no insignia. That's not what a gorilla does. A gorilla is a secret assassin. He's a secret soldier. You don't know who he is until he's standing over you, and the last thing you're going to see is him. But until then, he doesn't carry himself. He doesn't have a threatening mannerism about himself or none of that. You know, he carries himself in complete stealth. And so that's how we operated. He taught us how to go into the field, into the wilderness, and he taught us what weeds and what vegetation had protein in it that you could eat if you were hungry and you were on the run or you were in a rural combat situation and you couldn't get to the city and get supplies and get food. You know, he trained us in a lot of different areas that these other guys, we thought at first that he was just somebody who knew history, and he knew some poetry, and he probably could talk well, blah, 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 blah. Man, that ain't nothing. He taught us some real stuff, and he wouldn't tell us who he was or where he was from or what he was about. He wanted to first test us, and he said, there's a series of tests I got to take you guys through, and the last one, you cannot fail. So eventually, they shot him down, told him he couldn't go home, and he decided he was going to escape. And I told him, I'm not going with you, but I'll help you. And I say, I'm not going to tell you I'm going with you and then back out in the 11th hour. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't share the same amount of desperation as you, and I think I can get out through the parole process. But I'll do everything I can to help you as long as I conceal the fact, I can conceal the fact that I'm helping you and don't get caught doing so. You know, I let him know if you need to try to figure out how to make weapons, how to make guns, make something to blow your way out of here, cut your way out of here, whatever it takes to find that stuff in this penitentiary and put it together and make it work, I'm willing to help you with all of that. But I'm not at this stage ready to go with you, you know. And then eventually there were some racial problems in San Quentin, and they sent some of the people down who had killed some blacks, and he was walking around with Nazi armbands on, and I led a preemptive attack against him. And wound up going to San Quentin. That's when we got split apart. And he went to the hole because they thought that he had put that together. He was kind of upset with me because he didn't want me to leave that. It interrupted his escape plot down there at that time. And so anyway, I'm in San Quentin in the hole, and that's when I hear about the January 13th because I left Soledad July 6, 1969. And on January 13th, 1970, that was the day they killed the three brothers on the yard. And 3 days later, when they came back with a justifiable homicide from the courts, and the guard was killed on January 16th. And on January 17th, they indicted George, Jonathan, and Fleeta Drumgo, and they became the Soledad brothers. And they went to trial. And that pretty much politicized a whole lot of other people in the pen who didn't care. They were apathetic. They only cared about themselves and their own comfort and their own vices, you know. And they didn't care about other black people. They didn't care about people on the streets or anyplace else in the world. But the political attention we got from the whole world, the lawyers, the people that started visiting and coming and writing and stuff, the press, that kept our issues all the time on the front page of every newspaper. Every time they put on the earphones and listen to or any outside radio station, these conversations, these debates, and that brought them and drew them in. But it didn't. It made them very much aware and made them sympathetic to the cause, but it didn't actually make them any real militants or real revolutionaries, not the majority of them. And some of them would get out of prison, and they would say that they knew George, and they used to be his cell partner and all that kind of stuff, and they would get embraced out here on the street like they were heroes because they were associated with George Jackson when they probably had never seen him in the flesh. So, I mean, those were the days, those were the times. And then, you know, after I come out the hole, in 1973, everybody's staggering down the hall, loaded on heroin, loaded on acid. They're falling out the bed, having nightmares and hallucinations, and falling out the top bunk in the middle of the night. And, you know, some dude jumped over the fence and laid on the ground. They shot at him, and he said, "I'm the sun god. Can't nobody kill me." And the warden come on the public address system and say, "Man, if we have any more bizarre incidents like this, we're going to cut it out." And what he was saying, "We know that you guys are getting all this stuff in here. We'll let you do anything as long as you don't attack none of our officers." And they started letting us wear street clothes, platform shoes, and these long collar shirts and stuff, and the silk underwear, you know, and taking photos and being able to send the photos home, and even having weddings inside the penitentiary. And I kept telling these guys, "Hey, man, these are pacification measures, man. They're trying to calm us down, man, so that they can build more fortified prisons, and then they're going to take all this stuff away from you guys, you know." And they kept telling me, "Well, this is what George Jackson died for, so that we can dress up, so that we could frolic, so we could stay high, so we could do all the dumb shit. That's what he died for." That was the mentality. And that mentality persists right now until today. It ain't very much that has changed. And, you know, and that's the truth of the matter. You know, the movement, the revolutionary struggle, it's not a popular cause. It's a very unpopular cause because it makes you put too much on the line. It makes you really put yourself out there, make a real commitment, because you have to step across the line of which there is no return. And once you make that commitment, you can't hide. You can't run. You got to stay in it until you win it. And if you don't win it, you got to pay the price of losing like we're doing now. We're paying the price today for not having won.
True indeed. You know, yeah, I know there's a lot of things that took place during those years while you behind enemy lines. The people listen, how long did you stay behind enemy lines? For people listen, how long did you stay?
I was on the air about 10 years.
Okay.
I was, and back then that was a long time. I was in from 1965 to 1975. So I wasn't there a complete 10 years. I was there 9 years and so many months. It was like 10 years. I went in 19. I was almost 30 when I came out.
Okay.
But that was considered a long time. And as a matter of fact, when they gave me my parole, they interrupted my escape plot. Because I definitely was getting ready to leave because I had made up my mind. I don't care what they got to say. I'm not doing no more than 10 years. And I got to take my hat off to anybody who did 20, 30, 40, 50 years because they'd have had to kill me. They'd have had to shoot me off the gun tower. They'd have had to dig me up out of the tunnel. They'd have had to kill me because I just wasn't going to take nothing. And I told them that I'm not the kind of guy that's going to be there. I told them in 1974, I'm not going to be here in 1984, 94, telling some young kid what I was doing here in 1974. I'm not that kind of guy. And I say, hey, it ain't nothing y'all can do because you can't touch me until I bust a move first. You got to react to me, and I'm coming at you. You can believe that. When I get tired of it, I'm coming at you, man.
True indeed. You know, during your time in, you experienced the different developments in regards to people trampling equipment to the revolutionary title, right? But when the Crimson Bloods came to the prison system, how exactly was they embraced or accepted, or what was the response to them coming in with it, their gang mentality in the California prison system?
Well, you had a lot of guys who were afraid of them and who didn't like them and who wanted to suppress them. And that was not my attitude. I told them, those are our little brothers. I don't know why you're mad at them because of what you heard of them doing on the street. What you in here for? What was you doing out there? You know, you're doing the same thing. And now you want to move on them. And I said, that's counterproductive. Those are our little brothers. Those are bringing up the rear. They got the heart to fight the battles that you won't fight. And so when I met them in Chino, when they was coming in, and I was introduced to them, first I was led to the yard to see about 150 of them sitting together. Then I was introduced to the leader of them, a guy named Black Johnny, and I walked and I talked with him, and I told him, look, you can't stop Crippin' now. I said, because in here we at war. And every time that bus pulled up, we're looking to see who get off that bus. Is it a chump, punk, or a soldier getting off that bus? And I say, so everybody's going to want you. I told them, every group that's already in there is going to want you to join them. I say, but the best thing you should do is keep your own identity, keep your unity, but continue to fight our battles beside us. You know, bring up your own troops. But you're going to have to fight the same fight we fight. You can't stop Crippin' now. But you had others in there that thought that they were holier than thou. And so they started moving on them Crips, making some of them lock up, like they made Raymond Washington lock up, the leader. They made him go on protective custody. He stayed there until the rest of his people started coming in. Then he came out. Then they started waging war against the blacks who had made them lock up. And so the next thing you know, you got more blacks fighting against blacks for one reason or another than you have blacks fighting against the system or fighting against Nazis or KKKers, you know, or ADs. And so the whole thing just turned around, man, and went backwards. And then you got these kids coming in. It's hard to get them to forget. They come into prison for killing each other. And since they had blood feuds on the street, it's almost impossible to make them shake hands. Because they didn't promise a dying comrade, "Don't worry, comrade, I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to avenge your life against the enemy." So trying to have a peace conference with them, they can't even stand the word peace. It revolts them. It just makes their whole body revolt when you use the word peace. And when I talk to them, I never talk about peace. I talk about reconciliation, or I talk about creating a stage for reconciliation, or I talk about how it's not so important that they just go around hunting somebody to kill. I'm not trying to tell you to put your weapon down. I wouldn't disarm you. I'm sitting here telling you to put your stuff down and your enemy turn the corner and blow your ass up. That'd be my fault. So I'm not trying to disarm you, but I'm trying to tell you not to just go around hunting one another. Don't push that line that you've got. And every argument, every fight doesn't require a killing, you know. And so I get along with them. They start, I get along with Crips and Bloods. I mean, real good, real good. I mean, they really embrace me. They give me more respect than I think I deserve. But like they say, I talk to them like a big homie. I don't talk to them like a damn fool, some old fool telling them what not to do, especially when I can't give them something to do that's going to benefit them.
True indeed, true indeed. Your name has been mentioned in various books by David Hillier, Tom Hayden.
What's the book that Tom Hayden wrote? I heard that he has almost a chapter on me, but I never knew the name of the book.
I know right now, top of my head, right?
It's all right. You can text it to me because it'll come to me.
Yeah. The books by Dan Berger, you know, it talks about you in regards to certain aspects in the prison movement. Especially, what was your relationship with David Hillier?
Well, when I first met David Hillier in Vacaville, I was very hostile towards him. And the night that I got there, some of his people marched up to me when I put my property down in front of my cell door waiting for the guard to come and unlock it. And they came to me standing at attention saying, "Chief want to see you." I said, "Who?" They said, "Chief." I kind of laughed. I said, "I don't know any chief." He said, "Chief David Hillier, chief of staff of the Black Panther Party." So he came to me two or three times. And one time he came to me, I told him, I said, "He can get out of my face." I was going to do something bad to him. So eventually I put things together in my cell and I let them walk me to where he was standing in the hall up against a gate. And he had a smile on his face. And he was trying to welcome me. I wouldn't shake his hand, and I told him, "We have to talk, man." I said, "We got some serious talking to do." And so he said, "Okay." And so I told people that I was closely related to in there that I wanted to walk and talk with him because I wanted to understand exactly why people who grew up together, shared popsicles and rode tricycles together, were now on the street killing each other over some slight difference in political line or opinion. And people were being found in the desert, floating in swimming pools. There were a lot of mysterious killings going on. And some of it was police activity. Some of it was different rivals throughout the movement killing each other. And a lot of it was just mysterious killings, and it was splitting people up, making people turn away. And I wanted to know, I said, I'm on my way out there, and I want to know what's going on and why. I don't want you to betray any secrets of the ruling members of the party, of the central committee, but I do need to know what the hell is going on out there and why. And so I walked and I talked to him. He would have a visit, I would have a visit. My visitors would not speak to his visitors or him. And the people that I was with had a contract out on his life, and I told him to hold up. Let me find out why we want to kill him before we kill him. And they wanted to kill him, Death Row Jeff, and Stubby Jack. So, you know, after 6 months of walking and talking to David, he tried to buy my friendship. And I said, my friendship is not for sale. I'm not for sale. I have no purchasing price. And, you know, at that time, the Panther Party and Motown had created a subsidiary a recording studio, and the Lumpins was recording records and signing, and they were making records in that studio. Elaine was actually recording in that studio, and so David had promised me a job within Motown, and I mean, I'm not interested in anything but the truth. I want to know why all of this stuff is going on out here. And I eventually found out he really didn't know, because when I asked people from L.A. that I knew real well why they were mad at David and were prepared to kill him, they said because more pastors was getting killed on his leadership watch. And like David said, they did not follow him. They did not follow the orders of the Central Committee. They was running around doing their own thing. And my position is, if you was a Cub Scout or a Boy Scout, and you was wearing a Boy Scout or a Cub Scout uniform, and you was doing everything but what the Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts was about, they would get rid of your ass. And I sat there and talked to them, heard them testify to the fact that they were going on adventurous trips in the streets because they was bored, because they didn't think the party was aggressive enough, so they was going out getting killed, hunting down police and stuff. And matter of fact, more people got killed on Geronimo's watch, not on David's watch. That was on Geronimo's watch. And so, oh, man. I eventually, after talking to him for 6 months and listening to him in every situation and watching how he handled himself, I found him to be probably the most administrative-minded Panther I had ever met in my life. Matter of fact, he is so well at administration. I remember when Levi Strauss and some other company were fighting each other because they wanted him to work with them in an administrative capacity. And he didn't take a job with either one of them. When he got out, he became a union arbitrator out of San Francisco in the Bay Area. So I found out that all the superstitious reasons that people wanted to hate and move on him were false and had no foundation, no truth to them. And so I called the contract on his life, took it off his life. You know, they ain't gonna touch this man. Because you're taking these attitudes like, if I'm mad at somebody and I die, and you never asked me what was on my mind, but because of your loyalty and friendship and comradeship with me, you're just going to take the position. If I kill this person, Kumasi would be proud of me. You didn't ask me if I wanted you to do that. You didn't ask me if I wanted to do that. You just took that upon yourself. That's your imagination, you know, that tells you. And your ego is telling you, this is the way I should represent myself. This is the way I should represent his history. And this is going to make things better if I do it. This is going to create a lot of changes, and it's going to benefit everybody if I go out and do something crazy like that. And you never got the sanction. You never got the authorization. You never got the backing of anybody. This is coming out of your mixed up head. And so I didn't allow it. I didn't permit it. I seized leadership. I asserted my leadership over the people who was talking about doing it. And so I had to have a meeting with them. And Tony was at the meeting, and OC was there, but I wouldn't tell them because they're so aggressive. They would have attacked these people if they thought these people was even thinking about doing something to me. But I armed them, and I put them in a position to attack and win. And I put several people in a position, and I called the people to a meeting with me on the yard. And when I thought all night long, I sat up and I said, what can I tell them to make them sure to get off the pot without having to kill them? And when I got them in front of me and they introduced the guys who were there secretively who didn't want to reveal themselves, I said, no, you bring them to the meeting too. And when they came to the meeting, I asked them, I said, the first order of business today is the question of you killing me. Let's talk about that. Oh, we don't want to kill you. Well, they should have never said that. If you don't want to kill me, you ain't going to kill nobody in this penitentiary without my position and authority. Unless you kill me first. And if you kill me or anybody else, and the rest of us, wherever we are, don't sanction this, don't agree with it, don't authorize it, don't back it, you can't go nowhere without getting killed. So the first thing you better do is understand that you don't have the power, the authority, or anything else to just take off and do your own thing in a way that is going to affect the rest of us, good or bad. And I made them stand down on that. I disarmed them, and I told them, you don't have a spit fight with nobody in this penitentiary unless I authorize it. In the meantime, you go into political education class and find out who you are, what you are, and what the hell you're supposed to be about besides this bullshit. And so that's how I handled that. And when I got out, me and David were still friends. The reason why I knew Tom Hayden, because when Tom Hayden decided to go into mainstream politics and run against Tony for Senate, he asked David to be his advisor to the black community, and David told him, I'm from Oakland. L.A. is Kumasi's town. Let Kumasi be your advisor to the black community in Los Angeles in regards to your political race. And that's how me and Tom Hayden hooked up. And when he lost that race and he decided to start the campaign for economic democracy and lead and win the battle for rent control in the Santa Monica and Venice area, we were the black wing of that. At one point, we had to have a secret meeting up in the mountains of Santa Monica at Jane Fonda's ranch, and they had all these rich people up there, and they called a bunch of us out of the movement up there. And we stayed up there 2 or 3 days. And the reason they brought us up there, these were campaign organizers, campaign managers. These were rich people. And they told us, they said, think about the power that Martin Luther King had in this country. They said, first of all, they said, if black people in this country are dormant, the whole country is dormant. When black people are up and active, the rest of the country is active. Black people in this country have a hell of an impact on the culture and the political climate in this country. And they said, think about the impact that King had, and think about the impact that Malcolm had. Then they asked us, what if there was 10 Malcolms and 10 Kings running around the country at the same time doing their thing? What kind of political energy and power do you think would run across this land? And they wanted us to use our experience and contacts to go out, recruit, and develop 10 Kings and 10 Malcolms. We got into a fight with each other over money. And David kept saying, don't mention money. They know they're going to have to give us money to run offices, to rent offices for phone calls and bills. they're going to have to pay us salary. They're going to have to give us a bunch of money. They said, this is going to require a lot of money. This is a major, but one of the dudes in the party from the Bay Area talking about he had a master's degree, and why don't you put all the budget and the money in my hand and let me administrate this whole move, blah, blah. And David said, man, why don't you just shut up, man? They will get to that. They will. Matter of fact, we was up there. Dennis Kucinich was up there from Ohio. And it was some bodybuilding bodyguard flexing around us. And David asked Dennis Kucinich, he said, your bodyguard is a 3-degree black belt, right? And he said, yeah. He said, well, so is my nephew. He said, why don't you let my nephew fight your bodyguard? And if he kick your bodyguard's ass, why don't you give him the job? And he said, oh, that ain't nice. He said, well, tell him to quit walking around here flexing and carrying on because he ain't intimidating none of us. So tell him just calm his ass down. He can't be your bodyguard in our presence, you know. And eventually we got into it with each other, and they got us off that hill without us even knowing. They knew we was back in the city. They smooth got us up out of there because they got scared because we at the top of a mountain with a straight drop. There are no gates, no fences, nothing. And we got all these millionaires up there, and then we get in an argument with each other. So, you know, of course, you know, they told them, say, man, if we want to, we can do whatever we want to them. And so they hurry up and got us out of there. But even after that, me and Tom were still friends. Tom still did a lot, you know, did everything he could. He came into the street. He spoke in behalf of what he thought it would take to stop all this black-on-black killing and the gang warfare. And he said, matter of fact, you ought to treat them the same way you treat rival nations, the same way that you pour money into rival nations, the same way you make a deal with these rival nations. You should be making those kind of deals with these kids in the street. The only thing is the people around the world are fighting over resources, and they're fighting and killing each other over nothing. But you need to find some method of getting to them to where they're too busy enjoying the other side of life and don't have time to come out in the street and hunt each other. You're not going to get rid of violence. You're not going to get rid of crime. And you're not going to get rid of warfare until you eradicate poverty. You don't have that shit going on in no wealthy neighborhoods. You don't have it. And that was the thing that Stacy Peralta, who produced Crips and Bloods Made in America. When we went to Sundance Film Festival, he asked the white folks there, when they said, man, how could you do what you did coming out in the street with them young blacks and they got AK-4, wasn't you scared of them AK-47s and other guns that they flashing on camera? And he said, let me ask y'all something. He said, if white kids in Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, or any other rich community start bringing guns in school and killing each other in the streets, how long would it take you to stop it? And they said, oh, we'd nip that in the bud. He said, well, they right across the freeway. You should be able to smell the gun smoke and hear the gunfire and the sirens that blast 24 hours a day. Why do you act like it's not happening? And why do you act like it could never happen here in your own neighborhood? So, you know. People are just unrealistic, man. They have unrealistic approaches to real-life situations.
True indeed. True indeed. I know we got like 13 minutes left. Why don't you tell us about your appearance on the documentary Blood and Crips Made in America? You know, then what made you prompt this?
It was just a thing where we had been trying to get people to do a piece on Slauson, on the history of Slauson. And we had been trying to get that done for years, and we wind up meeting with QD3 and some other folks. And at first, I remember QD3 sending some woman, some real fine woman to us, and she had a camera. And as soon as she came to and spoke to us and shook her hand, she pulled the camera out and started shooting. I said, oh, no, you don't. They don't do us like that. You put that shit down. You know, they'll come over here and exploit us like that. So she goes back and tells him that, you know, we didn't go for the trick, the game. And I wrote him a letter through a lawyer. And the title of the letter was No Guns, No Funerals, No Shit If. Let him know, if you do any film work with us, we want everything that we got coming. We want it in signature, and we want it in monies. And if you do a piece with us and it goes to syndication or it goes into some kind of a media apparatus that doesn't even exist right now, we want ours. In other words, don't beat us. And it won't be no guns, no funerals, and no shit. So all of a sudden, he started working on Made in America. And he had been in the street interviewing all these different gangsters. He's finished with them just about. When QD3 got in touch with Brother Crook and asked him, did we want to have some input in a urban film about gangs that they was already in the middle, almost to the end of. And Crook said, you got to talk to Kumasi. And when he called me, I said, well, I'm willing to listen to your pitch. And so he called Stacy Peralta, who was out in the street interviewing these guys, and say, man, this guy, he's ready to talk now. We better talk to him because we don't know what he's going to be like 10 minutes from now. You know, but right now, he's open to a conversation. So Stacy stopped what he was doing. They agreed to come to my apartment. I told Bird and Crook to come to my apartment. Stacy comes over, him and QD3, and Stacy tells me what he's doing, why he's doing, how he's doing it, and everything else. And I look at him and I tell him, I like what you're doing. I really like your ethical approach to this. But you got one hump to get over. He said, what's that? I said, due compensation. He said, oh, don't worry, I'll pay everybody. Then he looked at us and he said, what if I give you guys $5,000 a piece out front before I even pull out a camera? And I looked at them and I said, you better vote on this. I said, everybody else can come to our meetings, our conventions, you know, and they didn't tape us, they didn't film us, they didn't took us outside and interviewed us, and they never even gave us a copy, let alone a dime. And I say, half of them are not even interested in what we have a convention for. But they'll come because they're going to have a chance to videotape or audio tape this and then be selling cassettes and videos out the trunk like Nipsey does out of his trunk, like it's music. So really, they're exploiting us because this is not anything within their interest. They just see how they can make money off of us. And we got other people who produce us. They go to foundations and they get a bunch of money, and they don't even know nothing about this content, but they know who we are. And what they will do is they will produce us like they're producing a concert, and we're the guys that's supposed to come on stage and perform, and they collect the money, and we don't get nothing. And I've seen the ones who do get some, they get wine money. They get just enough money to go buy them a bottle of wine. And I've argued with them and told them, if we're fighting against exploitation, why does it matter who's doing the exploiting? How could you accept this? Why would you let somebody do this to you? You know? And, you know, don't nobody want to hear that. I'm supposed to be crazy. So anyway, that's what happened. She paid us $5,000 before we, all together, we made close to $10,000. In different increments, you know, and went to Sundance, and we had an opportunity to meet some people who would do what we really wanted to do and produce a major piece of work, historic work. But when we went to Sundance, they was having a writer's strike, and afterwards, after Sundance, they had a independent an independent distribution company. All those independent distribution companies went out of business. And so that stopped us. And plus, we didn't have nonprofit organizations. The people who had nonprofit organizations, they got funded afterwards. We weren't prepared for all of that. We didn't even know that was going to take place. When you look at that film, a lot of people think that we must have been sitting around in a circle feeding off of each other. None of us was at the interview at the same time. Each one of us was interviewed independently without nobody else being there. And the interesting thing was you got some of the same comments, the same attitude all the way around. And everybody pretty much backed each other's statement about what happened, why it happened, how it happened, because they were the right people. They were the ones that knew. They were the ones that was there. They were the ones who took part in that stuff. But Bird wasn't nowhere around. When I was interviewed, I was not there when he got interviewed, and the same thing with Crook. And then when we went to the screening of the film after it was finished, they watched that film and them youngsters jumped up, and after the lights came on and they said, oh no, they said, you can't release that film like that. It makes us look real bad. And I started laughing. I'm like, oh, you didn't know who you really were until you saw yourself on camera. That's who you guys are. And you don't even like yourself. So that baby said, man, you got to clean this up some kind of way. You can't release this. Life. You got to say something good about us. And then they turn around and say, and get them old guys out of here. They don't have no business in this film. Get them out of here. Why you even got them in this film? Yeah, they protested us even being in there.
Yes, sir. True and your point, sir, Elder Kamas. We got like 4 minutes left, right? Can you give your final thoughts? You want to leave it with?
No, I don't have any final thoughts because everything is continuous.
Okay. Yeah, we want to thank you for coming to our broadcast, sharing out your wisdom, understanding, making what we can do in the past, present, and the future, right? If you're anyone, any comrades, social, loved ones, please check out Georgia University. We can be found on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for name Georgia University. We have a website, which is www.georgejackson-edu.com. But I always have 365 days a year, and it's also approaching in a couple more months. So get yourself ready and educate yourself. Law of the Resistance, Law of the Guerrilla, Law of the New African Independent Movement, Free Your Land.
Okay, so that was it.